Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. We all know it's coming. We don't always know when or where. It's random, but we know it's coming. So why is it that we who are not quite 6 feet under tend not to plan for the day we are?
It's surprising because there are things, even for people that have very few assets, where a will can be very important to them.
Yes, we're getting your finances in order for the big dirt nap. College students, of course, think they're invincible, so they'll probably tune out for that story. They're more worried about paying the tuition bill. We'll ask whether it's a good idea to borrow that money from a stranger.
I call this the perfect opportunity storm. Banks have stepped up. Borrowing is on the rise. Rates are low.
Peer-to-peer student lending. That and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Falling home values, foreclosures, record gas prices, not to mention the food bill. Add it all together and you've got the perfect recipe for bankruptcy. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
In the first 3 months of this year, bankruptcies spiked by 27% over the same period last year, and it was a 110% increase over 2006. We are seeing those numbers come to life in our inbox here at Marketplace Money. Lots of questions about what to do when you've run out of options and are facing the absolute worst possible financial situation. Dave wrote to us from Columbia, Maryland, and we decided to get him on the phone to talk about his own personal credit crunch. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your situation.
Well, I had taken a position that required me to relocate. Between the time that we relocated and the house was on the market, though, the subprime mortgage issue came to light and the market started to collapse, as everybody knows, and it basically affected the price of my house. So my home, while I did not have a funky subprime mortgage, my home lost a significant amount of value when I came to sell it.
How much?
We lost about $100,000 on the house. We had to get a private loan for that. So we're currently paying our current mortgage and basically a payment, which is a little bit more than a mortgage, for a house we no longer own.
So what has that done to your finances?
Well, on top of that, my wife was back in school. We'd actually sort of run up some debt because she wasn't working, thinking that when we sold the house, we were going to have some extra money because the market was so great, and we were going to be able to pay all that debt down when she got back into the job market.
Is that credit card debt?
That was credit card debt. So that became an issue as well. We now had higher credit card debt, and we had essentially two mortgages.
So what have you done since this happened?
One of the first things I did was contact a consumer credit counseling agency to try and work out some sort of arrangement. While I was able to get some reduced interest rates, and that did help somewhat, I'm making the same payments that I was before.
How are you literally able to do that, given that your income, I assume, has not changed radically?
My income has not changed radically. My wife has gone back to work, and that basically keeps us from drowning, but just barely. So this past winter, heating bill, $400, $500, and $600 in some months, we were literally sinking then.
So what's the situation right now?
Right now, I'm trying to determine if I can make it through the summer. You know, my big concern is next fall and next winter again with heating bills, if the cost of living is going to increase, it's just going to make it that much harder for us to stay afloat.
What are the options that you are considering?
Bankruptcy is one. Part-time job is another. I have very deliberately avoided investigating bankruptcy just because I feel like somebody's going to say to me, it's my only option.
And what would that mean to you?
Well, it's completely demoralizing. I mean, you have a successful career. You spent your entire career trying to build up equity into things and to give yourself some sort of financial stability. You know, I kind of feel a lot of this was out of my control. The credit card debt certainly was under my control, but I took a risk there. I took a risk that the market wasn't going to change anytime soon.
When you think about the future, obviously bankruptcy is something that stays with you for a very long time. So it's a very serious step.
Absolutely, and that's why I have not contacted an attorney for advice, because I feel like they'll convince me that it's the right thing to do.
All right, well, we'll try to get some answers for you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Dave is far from alone in facing the possibility of bankruptcy. As we already mentioned, the statistics are growing. More than 91,000 people filed for it just last month. The American Bankruptcy Institute predicts new bankruptcies could exceed 1 million cases this year. We've asked Professor David Skeel to join us for some answers and background. He teaches finance and law at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to talk with you again.
So we've just heard from Dave, who is in a really serious situation and contemplating the possibility of bankruptcy. When is a negative situation so dire that bankruptcy becomes really the most appropriate step?
Well, the usual situations where you see people filing for bankruptcy are situations where they've had a sudden catastrophic change in their life, usually something like losing a job or a divorce. And if you have that sort of a catastrophe and you have debt that there's simply no way imaginable that you could pay off, that's the situation where bankruptcy makes the most sense. The harder call is where you do have some income, you have enormous debts, and it's not clear whether you can make it or not. And in those situations, I really think you have to look at all of the options a bit more carefully. And if you're thinking about bankruptcy, there are some real downsides to it. One is that any debt that you have secured by a mortgage on your primary home, you're not going to be able to affect in bankruptcy. You're not going to be able to reduce it in any way through the bankruptcy process.
Well, for Dave, you know, he certainly painted a picture of not being able to pay the most basic bills. Does that sound like a situation for bankruptcy?
Well, it sounds like a situation where he ought to seriously think about talking to a bankruptcy lawyer.
You know, there were some changes to the bankruptcy laws a couple of years ago that were supposed to make it harder for people to declare Chapter 7, Chapter 13. But it seems like we're seeing a lot more filings for relief these days. Is that true?
We really are. Before the 2005 changes, there were 2 million non-business bankruptcy filings. The year after that, there were a little less than 600,000. Last year, we were over 800,000. This year, it looks like we might be back up to 1 million. So there's no question bankruptcy filings are going up. To the extent the law was designed to reduce the number of filings, it sure doesn't seem to be doing that.
So what was in the law that was supposed to kind of put a damper on this sort of effort?
Well, there were a number of different things. The one that was billed as discouraging people who ought not file for bankruptcy was a provision known as a means test. And what that is a provision that determined whether you can repay some of what you owe. And if under the means test, the court concludes that it looks like you can repay some of what you owe, you often will be forced to file for Chapter 13. This is the repayment option. And the thought was, people who are using bankruptcy strategically will think twice as a result of this kind of provision. There have always been a few people like that, but my sense always was that the vast majority of people who filed for bankruptcy probably needed to file for bankruptcy. Unfortunately, the biggest effect of the 2005 changes was just to make bankruptcy more costly.
Well, David, thanks for helping our listener, Dave, in Maryland with his situation and giving us the rundown on what's going on with bankruptcy these days. Appreciate your help.
It is my pleasure.
David Skeel is a professor of corporate law and bankruptcy at UPenn. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriveand.com/retirement. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more online at saveandinvest.org.
Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, we've been getting a whole lot of confusing housing information recently. On the one hand, the National Association of Realtors says the number of Americans signing contracts to buy existing homes jumped in April.
Isn't it nice to get some good news?
It certainly is, but only a couple of weeks ago, we had the Case-Shiller Index, which is a very popular way to figure out what's going on with the housing market. Its index of home prices showed a decline of more than 14%. What
Ouch.
Is the deal here? When are we going to see a real market turnaround, if ever?
Okay, here is the safe forecast and the forecast that I believe. We're going to continue to see a downward spiral in prices. Look, a lot of buyers are out there, but they're looking for really good deals. And foreclosures, they're on the increase. But I actually think we're seeing some signs of life in the market. It's faint, but I think the market has a pulse.
So what are some of those signs?
The big price drop that you mentioned, the Case-Shiller Index.
Mm-hmm.
Well, recently we've seen an acceleration in the price decline. And what that reflects is the banks have thrown in the towel. They're just slashing the prices of foreclosed homes. They want to get that stuff off their books. Another sign, one of my favorite columnists, Floyd Norris, business columnist for the New York Times, had this really good article about the private mortgage market. Now, here's a stunning figure. I have to give you the numbers. In the final quarter of last year, the private mortgage market was only 18.6%. or less than 19% of the mortgage market.
Well, who else owns them then?
It's the Department of Veterans Affairs, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, Federal Housing Administration. But what he points out, the private share recovered to almost a quarter in the first quarter of 2008. So in other words, we're seeing a little more activity on the private end. So again, I take that as we're going to see a very slow turnaround in this market.
Is it concerning at all that the federal government, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the FHA, the Department of Veterans Affairs, they all hold such a big chunk of the mortgage market?
It's a real concern. And there are also some serious issues about the financial health of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
I mean, essentially, even though they are called quasi-government entities, the taxpayers would be on the hook if mortgages fail all over the place under these agencies?
There's no question about it. The way that I look at them right now, they're a big part of the housing rescue plan. That's one part of what the government is doing. And it's had this stuff like, what, Hope Now and Optimism Tomorrow, whatever you want to say. And most of those programs.
I think you've come up with a brand new program, Optimism Tomorrow.
I think I had. They haven't worked very well. However, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, that's actually worked pretty well. That's why I do take it as an optimistic sign that the private market is starting to stir, but it's not healthy to be in the situation that we're in right now.
All right. The Straight Story from our own Chris Farrell. We will check in perhaps the next few months to see if you were right.
Yeah, I know. One problem with this is you have it on tape.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, we start a series on something most of us would rather, and do, ignore. The fact that one day we will die.
You have to think about the people that you're going to give things to. And, you know, all of those are very serious things. So I think there's a reluctance to deal with it psychologically, and that's why a lot of people don't.
We will. The nuts and bolts of estate planning. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Today, we are going to start a conversation about the end. Formally, it's called estate planning. Now, we can all acknowledge that there are more important concerns than money when it comes to death and dying. But as we'll learn over the next several weeks, planning for the end of your life isn't all about you. It's also about the ones you will, at some point, leave behind. As part of this series, we're talking to people who deal with death on a regular basis. Today, someone who provides counsel to grieving friends and family.
My name is the Reverend Zelda Kennedy. I'm the Senior Associate of Pastoral Care and Spiritual Growth at All Saints Church in Pasadena. I'm a widow. One of the things that my husband said to me was that, let's sit down and talk about what's going to happen when I'm gone. how you will live when I'm no longer here, because he knew that he was dying. And at the time, I could not see how important that was. In fact, I didn't want to discuss it. I was like, let's not talk about that now. And his insistence was, yeah, we really do need to. And as a result of his doing that, once he died, I didn't have to wonder about what were the next steps, because they were already in place. And we did them together, which is the beauty of this. I feel that financial planning is essential. It alleviates the stress of where do I go next? What do I do next? Where is the money coming from? How am I going to afford to live? How do I pay the bills? How do I pay for the funeral? All of those things are covered. And I would recommend to any family that they do this. Somehow we seem to think that if we start to plan for an end of life or an accidental death, that we're sort of making that happen, which is, I think, the reason why so many people don't do it. But I would say you must, and particularly if you have children, even if you don't have children, you must. There's a story of a member of our community who came in to share that as a result of her mother's poor planning, not having a will, she and her sister were just fighting each other because they each wanted control of the estate. And the mother did not make it clear, and as a result, they were just at each other for that. And what I'm finding is when families don't plan, it creates that type of tension, that type of friction in the family, and it renders difficulty for the family. When my husband was dying, I wanted to fully concentrate on him. And when we talked about the finances, when we talked about his memorial, when we talked about making sure that I lived a full life, I thought, oh dear. After he died, I didn't have to worry about the finances. The memorial was already planned. I was a wreck. There was no way that I could have done that. But it was already taken care of. So all I had to do was get dressed. All I had to do was show up at my lawyer's office. Those things were taken care of. And when I look back on it in retrospect, those were gifts. And I'm so grateful that I lived with someone who had the presence of mind to insist that we do that.
That was Reverend Zelda Kennedy of All Saints Church in Pasadena, California. And so let's move to the practicalities: wills, trusts, power of attorney. Joining us now and over the next few weeks is John Ventura. He's the author of Kiplinger's Estate Planning. And John, let me ask maybe an obvious question. Zelda dealt with this a little bit. Why do so many people simply not think about this?
You're right, Tess. The studies that I've seen say that 55% of the American public doesn't have the basic estate planning tool, which is the will. There's a couple of things that are happening. One is, I think, a psychological thing. People feel like they're too young to even deal with these kind of issues. You're dealing with the end of your time. You have to think about the people that you're going to give things to. And, you know, all of those are very serious things. So I think there's a reluctance to deal with it psychologically, and that's why a lot of people don't.
So people certainly don't want to face their mortality. But I wonder if also there might be some conventional wisdom out there that wills are really only for people with a lot of money.
Yes. It's surprising because there are things, even for people that have very few assets, where a will can be very important to them. Say that a person doesn't have a lot of assets, but say they have an automobile. Mm-hmm. One of the problems that an heir would have in dealing with that automobile is getting the automobile's title placed in their name. And the probate process allows you to do that. So if you have a will, then you can get that title transferred more easily. The other issue is if you have minor children, even if you don't have a lot of assets, it's almost essential that you have a will, because if you don't, there are two aspects of care for them that are going to be ignored. One is, by a will, you're going to be able to name the guardian that's going to take care of those children. And you also may be naming the guardian that's going to be taking care of the property that you may leave to help those children, and that may be two different people. And if you don't have those people named, then the court is going to appoint someone, and it may be someone that you may not like or want to raise your children.
What happens if you die without a will? What's the process?
It's called dying intestate. Basically, what happens is any property that belongs to you and you die without a will, if you have a spouse and no children, everything goes to the wife. However, if you have a wife and you have children, then part of the money goes to your wife, and also part of the money goes to your children. What if you have children from several different marriages? They may all have a claim in this, and if you die without a will, you may find that all these different parties may end up fighting with each other over who's going to get what.
At what point in your life do you need to start considering the idea of a will? I mean, if you're in your 20s, you're single, it's just you, do you need to bother with it?
I think so. You know, nowadays, a lot of people are starting their careers right out of college. They're going to start to build wealth. They're going to, within a matter of a few years, probably buy a property, buy a home, a condo. And you still want to have the right to make the decision who's going to get these things. So the earlier you can start dealing with that, the better.
Once you get married, if you do not have children yet, and most states will automatically give your estate to your spouse, do you still need a will?
I think you do need a will. I'll give you an example, a famous example of this. Clark Gable, a famous movie star in the old days, had a will. At the time that he created this will, it was just his wife and he. So he left in the will everything to his wife. And in that will, he specifically said, I have no heirs, I have no children, so everything is going to go to my wife. Now, unfortunately, he didn't update that, and his wife got pregnant. He did a movie called The Misfits, which many people think it was such a physical movie that it exhausted him, and he ended up dying in a situation where he didn't put anything in there about that child, and he should have been updating it all the time.
So what happened?
If his wife had not survived him, if they had died together, say it was an accident or something like that, the court would have decided who was going to raise that child and who was going to be the person that was going to manage the wealth, the money that Clark Gable had built over his movie career for the benefit of the child.
All right. Well, later in the show, we'll be talking with John about exactly what you need to do to get a will done. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
And we're interested in your questions about estate planning. Send them to us at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriven.com/retirement. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
It is time for Getting Personal, and that's when we answer your questions about money and finance. And with me, once again, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. You ready for some calls?
What are people going to ask this time?
We're going to find out. First, we've got Bill on the line from St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Tess.
So what's your question for Chris today?
I have got some relatives in southern Minnesota who are looking at what they call a charitable remainder annuity trust. They've got some highly, highly appreciated farmland, and the promoters of this arrangement are claiming that they would get a large tax deduction and also eliminate capital gains by transferring these farmlands to a charity and then receiving an income stream. And I'm just wondering how safe and how secure this arrangement would be. They're 70 and 71 years old.
What kind of appreciation are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking substantial. The farmland was purchased 40 years ago for about $400 an acre. The offer is about $5,100 an acre. The promoters of this arrangement are really talking virtually 90% of the asset be transferred or gifted.
Chris, have you ever heard of something like this?
Yeah, it happens a lot. First of all, the charitable remainder annuity trust is very legitimate. But the way for people to be thinking about this is, you know, when you retire, a lot of us want to have a secure income. And at the same time, it might be important for you to give to a charity. So there's this a wonderful thing. You go to American Red Cross or whatever college or university you went to, and they'll have a department of planned giving. And there's a number of different arrangements that you can make. But if you sort of boil it down to its essence, you turn over to an irrevocable trust, and it provides you an income, and you get that steady income. You might set it up both for the survivor, too, so the husband and the wife. And then when the last survivor dies, the money goes to the charity. There are tax benefits to doing it, but is this a charity you really want to give money to? You always want to start out with what's the basics, what's the fundamentals, and put the taxes aside. And then you look at your finances, you say, but I also need an income. I can't give it up right now. This can be a very good arrangement.
Okay.
But you've said a lot of things that make me nervous. This much of their assets tied up in the one thing? I don't understand that. Secondly, one of the best things that you could do, you know, is to hire a fee-only certified financial planner to say, what are my options? How am I going to be best for the rest of my life for what I want to do?
All right. Does that help you out, Bill?
Yeah, it does very much.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for the call.
Thanks again for taking my call.
All right, if you've got questions, just head on over to our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, let's reach into the email bag. And Gary writes in from Colchester, Vermont. And he heard us talking in a straight story a couple of weeks ago. You remember we were discussing the settlement between TransUnion and a bunch of folks who used their credit service. And you were praising the announcement that they were offering free credit scores to consumers.
That's right.
Gary says he read that the TransUnion score is different from a FICO score.
He's correct.
And if you want the FICO score, you're going to have to pay extra. Now, this is something that we discussed, which is the fact that you can get credit reports for free once a year through annualcreditreport.com, but you have to still buy the FICO score. So he wants to know, first of all, the difference between FICO and the TransUnion score and then how that all fits into the settlement.
Your FICO is, it's the 800-pound gorilla. Mm-hmm. All right. So the TransUnion score is still valuable, and the numbers don't exactly line up, but they should come fairly close. What it does seem is that the FICO score has a slightly greater emphasis on payment history, the longer period of time. The TransUnion score has a slightly greater emphasis on, you know, what is your credit limit and how much credit do you have available. So there are some minor differences. You can also go to bankrate.com. They also have information on what are the differences between the different scoring methods. It's really important that the information in your credit report be accurate in all three credit reporting bureaus. A lot of times the difference might be there's some information with TransUnion and Experian, but it's not the same information with Equifax. Mm-hmm. So one thing you can do is smooth out all your information, make sure that it's reasonably accurate, and that will help a great deal in terms of smoothing out what is your credit score.
Thanks again for writing in, Gary. We hope that helped out. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link there. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. June is the busiest month for weddings, and that means brides and grooms will finally be receiving all those lovely things they listed on their registries, like that 50-piece set of fine china. One day, they'll break a plate or two. Yes, they will. And they'll wonder how to replace them. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we visit a store in North Carolina where finding that odd gravy boat or serving spoon is their bread and butter.
This is definitely the ones you were looking for.
Yes, it is.
Good. Okay. Is there anything else you want to look at today while you're here?
My name is Bob Page. I'm CEO of Replacements Limited.
We handle a whole array of collectibles like figurines and all kinds of collector plates. Our business has over 11 million pieces, and we get in another 40 or 50,000 pieces of inventory weekly. It all started back quite a few years ago in the late 70s. I had gotten interested in the flea markets, and my love of the flea market and the fact that I hated my job were the two things that propelled me to start Replacements Limited. Replacements was started long before eBay, but it has affected our business. I do think that before it was harder for people to find things, and eBay has basically driven down the prices on most items because things that used to be considered rare are now fairly easily available. Well, in 1981, I think our annual sales were $152,000. This past year, our sales exceeded $80 million. And, you know, I do get a salary, but I don't know exactly what my salary is, around $200,000. On one of my trips out to Arizona, I found this in an antique mall there. We had to send a truck out to get this, and it had to be disassembled to bring it in because it was too large to fit inside the truck. When a customer breaks a piece out in the showroom, we've always absorbed that. We've never asked anybody to pay for that. Here are the dogs. That's Toby and Trudy. They've had three litters of puppies, which have gone to all of the employees here at Replacements. One interesting request that we had, there was a film crew filming a Fancy Feast commercial, and they have a cat on there that's eating out of a, in this case, it was a Waterford Sherbet collector plate, and the cat had broken it. So they had actually emailed us a picture, and we were able to identify the pattern, and we overnighted the piece to them so they could film again the next day. When you're looking for a specific thing, then it stands out more than all others. Because sometimes I go through an antique shop and somebody said, well, did you see that piece of furniture? And I thought, well, no, I didn't see that because I wasn't looking for furniture.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Kelly Alexander. Coming up, where there is a will, there's a way to make sure your wishes are followed.
You have to think about all your assets. Where are your assets? So you want to put in the will enough information for an executor to know where all your assets are.
And students have a new way to get a college loan. It's called peer-to-peer lending. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Back to our conversation about estate planning. Earlier, we explored why just about everybody needs, at the very least, a will. So how do you get started? John Ventura is the author of Kiplinger's Estate Planning. Welcome back, John.
Thanks, Tess.
Let's start with the difference between a will and a living trust. What are those two?
A will is a document that actually is a set of instructions about what you want to happen to your assets, you know, who's going to get what and how they're going to get it. Your wishes in that will are given force through a probate system, and it all happens after your death. Now, a living trust is a document. It's actually a legal entity where you transfer assets into a trust that has an executor and a beneficiary, but you do this while you're alive. It could be that you would set up inside that trust the ability to take care of someone. And the difference is that if you die and you have a living trust, that living trust and whoever the executor is would continue to take care of your wishes without having to go through the probate system. And the difference is that in the probate system, the distribution of your assets may take a long time.
Let's go to the specifics of putting together a will for yourself. What are the very basic points that you want to make sure to hit? Is it all about money?
No, it's not all about money. The first thing I think you need to look at is, do you have any minor children, or do you anticipate having minor children? And specifically designate a guardian for the child or the anticipated child, and a guardian for the property that that child's going to get. And it may not be the same person. And then you have to think about all your assets. So one of the issues is, where are your assets? So you want to put in the will enough information for an executor to know where all your assets are. Like, for instance, there was a case where a woman had a lot of jewelry. Everybody knew that she had a lot of jewelry, and it was very expensive. She gave no indication in her will where that jewelry was. No one could find it, and only by accident it was discovered that she kept the jewelry wrapped up in tissue and placed inside the spindle of toilet paper. So it was only after one of her daughters went to use the restroom that they found the jewelry. So you have to pay attention about giving the information that you need to find all your assets. And then you need to be very specific about how you want those assets to disperse. Picking the executor of your will is very, very important.
So how do you do that? How do you come up with the person that you want to entrust that responsibility to?
You know, it's very hard. A lot of people go to the person in their family that they think has the maturity and the authority enough to deal with all the other relatives. Like, for instance, Elvis Presley picked his dad, but he did an unusual thing. He had co-executors. He had a bank trust department. Once his father reached an age where he couldn't be the executor and make all the decisions and do all the work that was necessary, he had a bank that was backing him up. Some people pick people that they've had business dealings with, like a business partner. And, you know, the person that has to do that is a person that's going to have to gather all the information about your estate. They're going to have to make sure debts are paid. They're going to have to make sure everything is transferred properly to the people that is supposed to get the assets. And it could be a lot of work. So you've got to get somebody that's going to be willing to put in all that effort and is going to do it the way you want to.
Let's talk about the format of a will. Can it be handwritten, videotaped?
It can be handwritten. Videotape is not approved right now.
But for the most part, do you want to type it out and get a notary public and a couple of signatures?
Yeah, you want to have witnesses. You want to have the basic things like you're an adult over 18, you're of sound mind. You want to have those kind of languages, and you want to be specific. Quite frankly, I'll tell you a thing that's happened in the estate planning area. There has been a tendency for people to try to do these things on their own. And there has been a lot of software created to help people do their own wills.
Mm-hmm.
You can go on the internet and have that done as well. One of the consequences of that is a lot of estate planning attorneys have reduced what they would charge to do a simple will. It doesn't make sense to do it yourself when you can have someone do it for you inexpensively and can ask you all the questions that you need to consider when you're doing your will, and you may not think about it if you do it yourself.
Is the will the place where you also want to put your final arrangements?
No, you don't want that. There may be some delay, and once you die, things happen very, very quickly. There's going to be decisions about a funeral home and whether or not you want to be buried or not. That needs to be a separate document, and that needs to be available to the person that's going to take care of your affairs immediately. It may be a spouse, but it should be somebody in addition to a spouse as well that can jump in and do the things that are immediately necessary. There's a lot of things that happen when a person dies. You have to get copies of death certificates. You need to deal with the funeral home and getting those death certificates, and you need at least 20 of them to be able to send to creditors. Besides doing all those things, you want people to know what the instructions for you are when you're being buried, and you want that information given to them as quickly as possible.
John Ventura is the author of Kiplinger's Estate Planning, and he's with us for a few weeks now to talk about how you can figure out how to plan your estate. And John, we'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Thanks, Tess, for having me on your show, and I look forward to it too.
And next week, we'll have some more details on living trusts. And we're looking forward to hearing about your experiences with estate planning. Drop us a line. We're at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriveand.com/retirement. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, online at kauffman.org.
All right, we're back with Getting Personal, and Simon from New York City dropped us an email, and he wants to know about something called rewards checking accounts. He says they generally offer 6% interest for using their check card 10 to 15 times a month. I assume that that is the ATM card that you can use at retailers. And he wants to know if there's any sort of catch to these accounts. Are they FDIC insured? How long are these rates going to last? And my friend, if you can predict how long these rates are going to last, I'd like you to take over all of my finances.
Well, here's my safe forecast. Not for long. Typically at that rate, 6%, my eyes are a little bit going, that's a teaser rate. A couple of things. The rewards checking account has grown in popularity. It's very popular in community banks, internet banks. Essentially what it is, it's a checking account with a CD rate attached to it. And in return, you give up some flexibility. So you agree, I'll only use my ATM card so many times. Now think about how often, if you use your debit card, how often you actually do use it. You go to the machine, but you may also use it at the grocery store, at the bookstore. It's very easy to go over the limit of, say, 10 times in a month. And you also agree that you don't do any paper transactions. Everything's over the internet. So you get your statements over the internet and you don't go visit a bank teller. So there are these limits. There are these restrictions. Be aware of them. But there is nothing wrong with it whatsoever. It can be a very good product if you can live with these restrictions. And, you know, what I always have to do when it talks about banking is, yes, you want to make sure that this is an FDIC-insured institution. That is actually really the key in the environment that we're in today. I mean, you want that always. You just always do. But, you know, okay, let's just take a moment's pause and say, in the environment we're in today, you especially want that FDIC insurance. You don't want to take any risk with your checking account money. And if they're not paying you anything, so what? But if they're willing to pay you a little bit more and you can live with the restrictions, I don't see the downside.
All right. The website is marketplace.org. And when you land there, just go to the Getting Personal page and send us a question. Or you can always give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that, by the way, M-O-N-Y. All right, Chris, our next caller is Michelle, and she's in Austin, Texas. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Is it safe to assume you're a Longhorn?
I would say so, yes.
Are you studying there at UT?
Yes, I am. I am a PhD candidate for neuroscience.
Any chance you'd go into, like, behavioral economics?
I'm not really sure. I'm just kind of avoiding going into the real world by continuing in school.
Hey, why not? So what's your question for Chris today?
Well, my father went to Costa Rica, and he formed a corporation to build a retirement house. And I was wondering if that's something that I could do here in the States, like get a couple friends together, like, the market here seems pretty good. It's the lowest APRs on mortgages in a really long time. There's falling prices. And I don't really have much money to invest myself, but I've got four or five friends. We could all get together, pool our resources. I didn't know what's involved in forming a corporation to buy a house.
I don't think you need to form a corporation to go in on a house with people, do you?
No, you don't need to form a corporation. There's all kinds of, the jargon term is equity sharing arrangements.
Right.
And so you put several people on the deed and they put money in. And then you have a lot of questions that you have to pursue, you know, in terms of making the payments on the mortgage and the utilities and renters and who's going to live there and who's going to get the tax benefits and how the tax benefits going to be divided.
And making sure that all your friends will pay their portion of the mortgage.
Right. And just making sure that in a couple of years, your four or five friends are still your four or five friends.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the big risks that is attached to this. So what I would really do is search out for really good real estate attorney, because you're going to need to work with a real estate attorney no matter what.
Yeah.
And you want to work with a real estate attorney who knows the market. And then it's sort of like figuring out what's the arrangement, what's the payback. There's a lot of flexibility in setting up equity sharing arrangements, but everything needs to be spelled out.
Yeah.
Even among friends, what we've all learned is, you know, it really helps if everyone's on the same page, understands the same risks. And of course, the big part of it is who's going to manage, who's going to watch, who's going to be responsible for the property. Because once you have four or five people, they're not all going to be looking at it.
Yeah.
I think it's a great idea. It's an intriguing idea. I wouldn't be surprised if more and more people aren't thinking about it, mm-hmm. because it's a way of buying a home with equity and not taking on too much debt,
yeah.
and then sharing the appreciation. That's the basic deal.
It seems like it would be a good deal for everybody involved, but it's not going to be like a windfall, like I'm not going to make $1 million.
Right.
No, but I also have to just say something that you said earlier, just at the relay. It's one of my favorite commencement addresses by George Plimpton, and I believe it was at Princeton. I can't remember where he said it, and he was looking at a crowd of people, and he said, you know, you've all heard about the real world and you need to get out in the real world, and I have only one piece of advice for you. Don't. Stay. It's wonderful here.
Yeah.
So at least you're living up to his ideal.
All right. Does that help you out?
Yes. That's great. Thanks a lot.
Well, unfortunately, Chris, those are all the questions we can take. But Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Visit our website, it's marketplace.org, and click over to the Getting Personal page. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. The credit crunch is forcing more and more banks to get choosy about their borrowers. College students are getting caught in the squeeze as banks drop their student loan programs. A few have decided not to lend at all to the community college crowd. What to do? Well, some students are turning to the familiar world of social networking. Websites are popping up all over the place that connect students to strangers and family members willing to loan them money. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The Facebook generation has gone surfing for cash. That's what Amy McGowan did when she needed money for law school. The 24-year-old says she learned all about socializing on Facebook, but felt shy about raising money at sites like that.
The kind of personal information that's on the social networking sites is social. It's who you're dating or making plans for the weekend. It's not that sort of delicate. Hey, I'm broke.
So McGowan went to other websites that welcomed that message. She found plenty of lending sites marketing directly to students.
I'm in college and I needed some extra cash, so I went to the bank, right? Wrong. I went to Prosper.com.
Prosper.com gave McGowan two loans. Here's how it worked. Prosper, which lends to anyone, pulled her credit report. McGowan typed in the interest rate she was willing to pay. Average Joe's, with a little extra cash, then bid on her loan. They got a better interest rate than the typical savings account or CD pays. McGowan got a loan below bank rates. Prosper got paid for being the middleman.
So it's like eBay for student loans.
C.C. Shaman heads up one of Prosper's competitors. Shaman's site, called Finance.com, caters strictly to students. It just launched in March. Shaman says it was excellent timing. His site has already loaned out close to $50,000, and loan requests are rolling in.
I call this the perfect opportunity storm. Banks have stepped out. Borrowing is on the rise. Rates are low.
Other sites also see rainmaking opportunities. Loan requests on these sites range from $8,000 to $20,000. Multiple lenders put up anywhere from $25 to $200 to fund the loans, and the sites service them. A new site called GreenNote launched this month. It helps students pass the hat for college money among family and friends. The site also offers tips for student borrowers, like holding a pledge drive. You may be familiar with those.
The phone number to call is 414-1234. If you're driving home,
instead of a coffee mug or tote bag, lenders get the satisfaction of helping someone they love and some interest on a loan. These loan drives can be something of a guilt trip. I'm thinking of my nieces who sold me Girl Scout cookies.
Oh, oh, cookies!
If I can't turn down Thin Mints, how on earth can I resist giving a monster loan? And what if my nieces don't pay up? Penn State education professor Donald Heller says that's where GreenNote comes in.
They will be the heavy-handed intermediary telling me I've got to pay up rather than Aunt June and Uncle Bud making the phone call and saying, hey, you didn't make your payment this month.
The peer-to-peer lending sites are new, so there's little information on how often students miss payments, nagging or not.
Caveat emptor.
Buyer beware. That advice comes from Mark Kantrowitz. He runs the website finaid.org. He says don't bet all your money on one student.
You should spread it across multiple borrowers so that if any one borrower defaults, you still have the possibility of having the rest of your investment make out okay.
And if it doesn't make out okay, GreenNote doesn't guarantee its loans. Other companies like Finance do. But Kantrowitz says there's no guarantee any of these companies will be around in a few years when the loans are due. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace Money.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, finders, keepers, losers, weepers.
It's like finding money on the street. This is really what we're talking about.
Believe it or not, we're talking about Social Security. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Stephen Hoffman, Janae Darden, James Richter, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriven.com/retirement.
American Public Media.